From Pacifica, this is Democracy Now!
You know, there's no way we want a union coming in. We could lose a lot of the good things we just talked about. So welcome to Walmart. You're going to like it here.
Walmart allegedly discourages workers from joining unions in an employee training video. The video was posted by Human Rights Watch, which has released a new report called Discounting Rights, Walmart's Violation of U.S. Workers' Right to Freedom of Association. On this May Day, we'll take a look at the new report. Then former CIA officials criticize former CIA Director George Tenet.
Former CIA Director George Tenet, the con man from Queens, has succeeded in making a laughingstock of himself. Meanwhile, 3,350 of our young men and women lie dead on the battlefield, and we're supposed to feel sorry for George Tenet? Give me a break.
We'll speak with Ray McGovern, who spent 27 years at the CIA. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Hundreds of thousands of immigrants and immigrant rights activists are planning to rally across the country today on the anniversary of last year's historic May Day protests. Marches are planned in at least 75 cities across the country. Some of the largest protests are expected to take place in Los Angeles and Chicago. Several groups are calling for a boycott of work, school, and all consumer activity. In California, youth organizers said walkouts were planned in at least 20 Los Angeles middle schools and high schools. In Chicago, some 700 businesses are expected to close down today as part of the national boycott. In Fresno, organizers are holding a rally focusing on children whose parents have been deported. Groups are calling on Congress to reject all anti-immigrant legislation, to stop the government raids on immigrant communities, to stop President Bush's proposed guest worker program, and to demilitarize the U.S.-Mexican border. On Capitol Hill, the Democratic leadership is officially sending President Bush the new war funding bill today that sets a non-binding timetable for the withdrawal of U.S. troops from Iraq. The bill is being sent on the fourth anniversary of the day President Bush stood under a mission accomplished banner and announced major combat operations had ended in Iraq. President Bush is expected to veto the bill as early as Wednesday. In Iraq, the U.S. military announced five more troops died in attacks over the weekend. 104 U.S. troops died in April, making it the sixth deadliest month of the war. Meanwhile, at least 102 Iraqis died on Monday alone, including more than 30 in a suicide bombing that targeted a Shiite funeral. In the largest political development in Iraq, the largest bloc of Sunni Arabs in the Iraqi parliament is threatening to withdraw from the cabinet. In other Iraq news, one of the country's best-known bloggers has announced she and her family have decided to flee the country. The blogger, known as Riverbend, has been writing about the U.S. occupation on her blog Baghdad Burning since August 2003. In her latest post, Riverbend writes, "It's difficult to decide which is more frightening. Car bombs and militias, or having to leave everything you know and love to some unspecified place for a future where nothing is certain." In Washington, D.C., the second highest-ranking Democrat in the Senate, Majority Whip Richard Durbin of Illinois, has admitted he knew in 2003 the American public was being misled into the Iraq war, but remained silent. Durbin said last week, quote, "I was angry about it. Frankly, I couldn't do much about it because in the Intelligence Committee, we are sworn to secrecy." Durbin went on to say, "We can't walk outside the door and say the statement made yesterday by the White House is in direct contradiction to classified information that's being given to this Congress." In Israel, Prime Minister Ehud Olmert is fighting for his political life after a government commission harshly criticized his role in the Israeli invasion of Lebanon last summer. The report accuses Olmert of demonstrating a, quote, "severe failure in exercising judgment, responsibility, and caution" during the 34-day war. The report also singled out Defense Minister Amir Peretz and the military's former chief of staff, Dan Chalutz. This is Ruth Gavison, a member of the Winograd Commission.
"We determine that there are very serious failings in these decisions and the way they were made. We impose the primary responsibility for these failures on the Prime Minister, the Minister of Defense, and the outgoing Chief of Staff.
Polls show nearly 70% of Israelis want Olmert to resign, but he's refused to do so. While the Winograd Commission focused on how the war was managed, critics of the war say the largest mistake was Israel's decision to invade Lebanon. This is Ahmed Tibi, an Arab member of the Israeli Knesset.
The real failure is just the decision of getting on to this war and not the way the war was managed. I do believe that Israel again was proved that it's an army which has a state and not a state which has an army.
In Lebanon, leaders of Hezbollah say the report by the Israeli Government Commission confirms Hezbollah won the war last summer. Nearly 1,200 Lebanese, the vast majority civilians, were killed during the war. Israel lost 119 soldiers and 39 civilians. The Israeli nuclear whistleblower Mordechai Vanunu might be heading back to jail soon for speaking to the international media. In 2004, Israel released Vanunu after he spent 18 years in jail for disclosing information that proved Israel had a stockpile of nuclear weapons. After he was released, Israel barred Vanunu from speaking to the foreign press, but he defied the order. Vanunu spoke to several foreign outlets, including Democracy Now! On Monday, an Israeli court convicted him of violating the terms of his release from jail. This is Mordechai Vanunu's attorney, Michael Savard.
Today, in 2007, a person was found guilty of being in contact with other people, not for the content of what he said to them, but for the mere fact that he was talking to other people. This is not something that a liberal democracy in the 21st century should be doing, and this is a very frightening situation, almost Orwellian situation. Every Israeli has to fear.
Mordechai Vanunu will be sentenced in 2 weeks. After the court's ruling, Vanunu spoke with reporters outside the courtroom.
Today, we have heard the verdict say that Israel have atomic weapons. Everything is published here, and now the Prime Minister Ehud Olmert, Shimon Peres, can say to the world that Israel have atomic weapons, producing plutonium, neutron, and hydrogen bombs. All the bombs that Israel are refusing to accept and to admit that they have the bomb is here. By the Israeli state, by the Israeli court, this judge today said that I said Israel have atomic weapons, and he's finding me guilty of saying this truth. So you and everyone in the world can say that Israel have atomic weapons. They have plutonium, neutron bomb, and hydrogen bomb. It is writing here.
To listen to Mordechai Vanunu's interview on Democracy Now!, you can visit our website, democracynow.org. In Britain, survivors of the July 7, 2005 subway bombings are calling for a new investigation into what the government knew about the suicide bombers before the day of the attack. Up until this week, the British government had maintained the bombings came out of the blue and that intelligence officers didn't know any of the men involved. But it was revealed Monday, at the conclusion of an unrelated trial, that the ringleader of the subway bombing was under MI5 surveillance in 2004. In the trial, a jury sentenced five British citizens to life in prison Monday for plotting a series of bomb attacks. The government case rested largely on intelligence gathered in what has been described as Britain's most intensive surveillance operation ever. Investigators bugged more than 90 phone lines, sifted through 27,000 hours of video and audio intercepts, and logged more than 33,000 hours watching the men. In news from Washington, D.C., investigative journalist Murray Wass has revealed Attorney General Alberto Gonzalez signed a highly confidential order in March 2006, delegating two of his top aides extraordinary authority over the hiring and firing of Justice Department employees. The existence of the order suggests a broad effort was underway by the White House to place politically and ideologically loyal appointees throughout the Justice Department, not just at the U.S. attorney level. The two aides given the authority were Gonzalez's chief of staff, Kyle Sampson, and his White House liaison, Monica Goodling. Both Sampson and Goodling have since resigned. On Monday, Senate Judiciary Chair Patrick Leahy described the development as disturbing and highly troubling. Leahy said, quote, This secret order would seem to be evidence of an effort to hardwire control over law enforcement by White House political operatives. The Bush administration is proposing a major expansion of oil and natural gas drilling in federal waters off Alaska, Florida, and Virginia. The proposal would allow private oil companies lease 48 million acres along the coast where drilling had been previously banned. In news from Washington, 75 attorneys and legal scholars are heading to Capitol Hill today to urge lawmakers to reverse provisions of the Military Commissions Act that strip detainees at Guantanamo of the right to challenge their imprisonment. The attorneys picked a day for their lobby action because May 1st is recognized as Law Day inside the legal community. On Monday, President Bush issued a Law Day proclamation inviting Americans today to, quote, celebrate the Constitution and the laws that protect our rights and liberties. In Virginia, the state's governor has partially closed a loophole in the state's gun laws that allowed the Virginia Tech gunman, Sung Hui Cho, to purchase firearms despite a court ruling that he was a threat and needed psychiatric counseling. The names of anyone who's ordered to be dangerous and ordered to get involuntary health treatment will now be placed in a database which gun dealers must check before selling a weapon. However, the new executive order does not apply to gun shows in Virginia, where guns can still be bought without a background check. In environmental news, the New York Times is reporting climate scientists may have significantly underestimated the power of global warming from human-generated heat-trapping gases to shrink the cap of sea ice floating on the Arctic Ocean. Meanwhile, President Bush met with German Chancellor Angela Merkel on Monday to discuss global warming. They agreed more must be done to reduce greenhouse gas emissions, but the Bush administration remains opposed to placing caps on carbon emissions.
As I reminded the people around the conference table today, the United States could shut down our economy and emit no greenhouse gases, and all it would take is for China in about 18 months to produce as much as we had been producing, to make up the difference about what we reduced our greenhouse gases to. So it's a very important issue. It's got global consequences. The good news is that we recognize there's a problem.
A Spanish judge has indicted three U.S. soldiers in the killing of Jose Coso, the Spanish journalist who was killed when U.S. troops shelled the Palestine Hotel in Baghdad in April of 2003. A Ukrainian cameraman for Reuters named Taras Pratsyuk was also killed in the shelling. The Spanish judge indicted Sergeant Sean Gibson, Captain Philip Walford, and Lieutenant Colonel Philip DeCamp. The three men were charged with homicide and committing a crime against the international community. The U.S. says it will not hand over the soldiers to stand trial. One of the men, Philip DeCamp, is now an adjunct professor of mathematics at the College of William and Mary in Williamsburg, Virginia. In news from Latin America, Hugo Chavez has announced Venezuela will pull out of the World Bank and the International Monetary Fund. The Venezuelan president accused the institutions of exploiting small countries and of being a mechanism of North American imperialism. Meanwhile, in Cuba, up to a million people are expected to march in Havana today in an enormous May Day rally. Fidel Castro is expected to attend the rally. He has not been seen in public since July, when he underwent emergency surgery and temporarily transferred power to his brother, Raul. And New Jersey Governor John Corzine is back in the governor's mansion 18 days after he was critically injured in a car accident. Corzine apologized for not wearing a seatbelt at the time of the accident and for being in a car that was speeding.
I also understand that I set a very poor example for a lot of young people, a lot of people in general. And I certainly hope the state will forgive me. And I'll work very hard to try to set the right kind of example to make a difference in people's lives as we go forward.
Governor Corzine of New Jersey. And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. On May 1st, 2003, President Bush stood on the deck of the USS Abraham Lincoln under a banner that read, "Mission Accomplished."
Major combat operations in Iraq have ended. In the Battle of Iraq, the United States and our allies have prevailed.
4 years later, the U.S. occupation of Iraq continues with no clear end in sight. President Bush has promised to veto a bill being sent to the White House today by the Democratic leadership that sets a non-binding timetable for the withdrawal of U.S. troops. Meanwhile, the daily bloodshed in Iraq continues unabated. At least 102 Iraqis were killed on Monday alone, and the U.S. military announced 5 more U.S. troops died over the weekend. Now, in the 5th year of the war, yet another former Bush administration official is accusing the White House of manipulating intelligence to justify the 2003 invasion. George Tenet, the former director of the Central Intelligence Agency. Tenet's new book, At the Center of the Storm, went on sale on Monday. In it, he blasts the administration, saying it had no firm rationale for going to war. Tenet accuses the White House of trying to shift blame to the CIA by falsely asserting he told President Bush finding weapons of mass destruction in Iraq would be a, quote, slam dunk. Tenet also accuses Vice President Dick Cheney and his neoconservative allies of pushing the nation into war. Tenet writes, quote, there was never a serious debate that I know of within the administration about the imminence of the Iraqi threat. Tenet resigned in 2004 as the second longest-serving director of Central Intelligence. Bush later awarded him the Presidential Medal of Freedom, the highest U.S. civilian award. Now, 6 former CIA officials, including former top terrorism experts, are accusing Tenet of hypocrisy for not speaking out earlier. In a letter issued over the weekend, they call on Tenet to, quote, dedicate a significant percentage of the royalties from his book to the U.S. soldiers and their families who've been killed and wounded in Iraq. One of those former intelligence officials joins me now from Washington, D.C. Ray McGovern spent 27 years as an analyst with the CIA. Welcome to Democracy Now!, Ray McGovern.
Thank you, Amy.
Talk about what George Tenet has said in his book.
Well, it is true, of course, that the war was started on false pretenses. The intelligence was manipulated. But what George Tenet doesn't fess up to is that he was the manipulator-in-chief. We have documentary evidence that George Tenet, for example, told his British opposite number on the 20th of July, 2002, so 8 months before the war, that the intelligence was being fixed around the policy. It doesn't get any clearer than that. Those were minutes taken by a participant in a meeting at 10 Downing Street the same day, and the British government has vouched for its authenticity. So George Tenet is being a little disingenuous in suggesting that he's the fall guy here.
He says that he never said that Saddam Hussein having weapons of mass destruction was a slam dunk.
Amy, this is the most bizarre thing I've witnessed in many years of watching intelligence leaders. What he says is, when he said slam dunk, he didn't mean that the evidence of weapons of mass destruction in Iraq was a slam dunk. What he meant was that, Mr. President, we can make a slam dunk case for popular consumption with the public and with the Congress out of this evidence. Now, he thinks that's exculpatory? I mean, that's worse. Where is it in the director of Central Intelligence or the director of CIA's job description that he is to participate and help the president manipulate evidence in order to start a war that has no reason and that was completely unnecessary? You know, he's admitting to a more heinous offense than simply being wrong about the presence of weapons of mass destruction in Iraq. He doesn't get it.
One of the things the administration is putting out there is that George Tenet is not telling the truth. For example, about September 12th, the day after the attacks on the World Trade Center and the Pentagon, he wrote that he was going into the White House past Richard Perle, who said that this was linked to Iraq. It turns out that Richard Perle was not in the country that day. George Tenet asserts then he might have gotten the date wrong, but he didn't get the substance of the conversation wrong.
Yeah, Amy, he's got a whole bunch of things wrong, okay? Last night on Larry King, he was talking about Saddam Hussein's brother-in-law. Well, it wasn't his brother-in-law, it was his son-in-law. And that's important because his son-in-law was in charge of the nuclear, chemical, biological, and rocket programs in Iraq. He defected in 1995, and guess what he told us? He told us there were no weapons of mass destruction there. How did he know? He was in charge. He ordered them destroyed. Now, his testimony, the fact that he Talk to Us was used by Dick Cheney, George Bush, and other high officials to show the utility of defectors. But they stood the evidence on its head by saying he said there were weapons of mass destruction in Iraq when he said completely the opposite. And this was given, his testimony was given, that is, his debriefing report was given to Newsweek magazine, which published it on the 24th of February, 2003, 3 weeks before the war started, and unfortunately, the mainstream media neglected it. It was in a little Periscope section of Newsweek, and the mainstream media didn't think it important that the main reason adduced for starting this war was proven to be false through the voice of Saddam Hussein's own son-in-law, who knew what he was talking about and from whom all the other information that he gave was proven to be correct. So, you know, George Tenet knew that as well. So there's lots of stuff here that really smells to high heaven. But basically, you know, the main point is, yeah, George Tenet is right. The administration lied through his teeth to get us into this war. The only problem is George Tenet ought to fess up. You ought to say, well, yeah, I was part of that. I was part of that conspiracy. And this $4 million I'm making on this book, I'm going to give those to the families of those who are slain because of this deception and to the families of those who are lying around Walter Reed Hospital without this or that limb.
George Tenet says in his book that the origins of the National Security Agency surveillance, warrantless surveillance program, originated with Vice President Dick Cheney.
Well, you know, just about everything originated with Vice President Dick Cheney. He was quoted, well, actually, he spoke about 3 days after 9/11 saying, you know, we're going to have to do a lot of things on the dark side here. And so they included torture, of which he was the vice president for torture. They included warrantless wiretapping, where you and I can be wiretapped now, even though we're American civilians, and even though, to my knowledge, no one has revoked the Fourth Amendment. And all manner of indignities have been visited upon this country and on the rest of the world because of Dick Cheney. Yes.
I want to turn to the issue of torture. In the interview that George Tenet did on 60 Minutes on Sunday when he launched his book, he denied the CIA interrogation techniques could be defined as torture.
Let me say that again to you. We don't torture people. Okay?
Come on, George.
We don't torture people.
Khalid Sheikh Mohammed.
We don't torture people.
Waterboarding.
We do not. I don't talk about techniques and we don't torture people. Now listen to me.
Again, that's George Tenet speaking to Scott Pelley on 60 Minutes on Sunday.
I know that this program has saved lives. I know we've disrupted plots.
But what you're essentially saying is some people need to be tortured.
No, I did not say that.
You're telling me that the enhanced interrogation...
I did not say that. We do not torture... Listen to me.
Well, you call it in the book enhanced interrogation technique.
Well, that's what we call it.
That's a euphemism.
Well, I'm not having a semantic debate with you. I'm telling you what I believe.
Anybody ever die in the interrogation program?
No.
You're sure of that?
Yeah. In this program that you and I are talking about, no.
Have you ever seen any of these interrogations done?
No.
Didn't you feel like it was your responsibility to know what you were signing off on?
I'm not a voyeur. I understand what I was signing off on.
George Tenet being questioned by Scott Pelley on 60 Minutes on Sunday. In this program, no one died. George Tenet was being very careful there as he drank a sip of water answering Scott Pelley's question. Ray McGovern, your assessment of his answer.
Well, you know, Amy, this crowd thinks that if they say things often enough, he repeated, "We do not torture," 5 times within the space of one paragraph. And then if you bluster and bully and say, "Now listen to me, now you're not hearing me," that people will take you more seriously. This is ridiculous. Of course they torture. In the next sentence, he says, there were special circumstances. These were terrible people. The context of after 9/11 was such that we pretty much had to deal with these people with extraordinary... You know, it's... I don't know what he takes us for. Fools? I mean, Perhaps he never took logic, even though he went to Georgetown University. We used to take logic. And when you say we don't torture, and then you say these people had to be tortured, obviously, it doesn't parse. Now, I think John McCain was right in saying that I don't buy George Tenet's premise that lives were saved through torture. And I don't buy it either. And it used to be in this country, Amy, that torture was ruled out as inhumane, as unworthy of civilized nations. Actually, Patrick Henry himself said that we left the screw and the torture devices back in the old world. Torture doesn't work. You know, if you're a utilitarian, you should know that. Experienced intelligence officers know that. This ticking bomb in Times Square, it's a red herring. Never happens. Okay, and the other thing is, and not a small thing, Amy, I feel strongly that torture is intrinsically evil. It's in the same category as rape or slavery. Always wrong. And I think John McCain appreciates that in a special way. So to watch the director of Central Intelligence say, we don't torture, but we really do, really gives me a lot of pain.
Ray McGovern, you served at the CIA for more than a quarter of a century. You were one of the top briefers of Vice President George H.W. Bush. We are now 5 years into the war. This is the anniversary of the day President Bush stood under mission accomplished and said the major combat operations are over. It's the day that the Democratic leadership of Congress is sending up a bill to President Bush, which he promises to veto, that funds the war but also has this non-binding timetable for withdrawal. What do you think has to happen right now?
I think people like Dick Durbin have to change their whole mindset and realize that they are not a subservient branch of government. And I'm a Virginian, and I think George Mason and James Madison and Tom Jefferson are rolling over in their grave. Here's Durbin saying, I knew that the war was going to be fought on false pretenses, but I was sworn to secrecy. Well, he was sworn to defend the Constitution of the United States from all enemies, both foreign and domestic, and that's what he ought to have done. Classification is to protect sources and methods. It's not to protect presidents, okay? And so he should have come out and said, look, this is not what I'm hearing in the Intelligence Committee. Hold the presses. We're not going to go to war until I get satisfaction. He didn't do that. Now they're in the majority. They were in the majority then in the Senate, and they didn't stand up to it. Now, they have to stand up to it now because this country needs this war to stop. I hope they have the guts to do it.
That issue that you raise of Senator Dick Durbin saying that he was angry about it, but frankly, I couldn't do much about it because in the Intelligence Committee, we are sworn to secrecy. He was talking about being misled into the war. Durbin went on to say, we can't walk outside the door and say the statement made yesterday by the White House is in direct contradiction to classified information that is being given to this Congress. Why can't he say precisely that?
Sure he can. Sure he can. And for several years now, the people in the House have been saying, well, we can't do anything because we're in the minority. Well, in reflecting on this, I realized that when he did that or did not do that, the Democrats were in the majority in the Senate. And so what I'm saying here is that they have to step up to their constitutional prerogatives, their constitutional responsibilities, and make sure that this war stops, because there is no justification for the surge or for the funding other than to prevent the war from being definitively lost while George Bush and Dick Cheney are still in office. That's what our men are dying for, our men and women are dying for now, and it's unconscionable.
What do you think should happen if the president does indeed, as he has promised, veto the bill that has been sent to him?
I think that the Democrats need to go back to the drawing board and impose rather strict strictures in the next piece of legislation, and not simply fold their tent like Arabs and silently steal away. The conventional wisdom was that if the first bill was rejected, then the Democrats would have to give the president what he wants. What really troubles me, Amy, is that people like Carl Levin have played into that, have said, we will never refuse funding of the troops. And trying to piece together why Carl Levin would undercut the Senate Majority Leader, I found out an interesting thing, Amy, and that is that Carl Levin gets more money from the pro-Israel lobby AIPAC than any other senator. Now, do I suggest that he's doing this for the money? I think we have to give him the benefit of the doubt because he's one of the good guys. But certainly, he appears to be one of those folks, like the neocons, who can't see any daylight between what they perceive to be the strategic interests of Israel on the one hand and the strategic interests of the United States on the other. And when Olmert and Livni, the foreign minister, come here to the AIPAC meeting 4 weeks ago and say, don't show weakness on Iraq now. If you leave Iraq, that would make this area more dangerous for Israel. Oh, and for the whole world and for yourselves, too. My goodness, Amy, it's very transparent. If Levin is one of those people that can't see any daylight between our interests and those of Israel, well, he hasn't read George Washington's farewell speech, which warned against precisely this: passionate attachments, entangling alliances. That's what we've got, and that lies at the bottom of a lot of our troubles in the Middle East.
Ray McGovern, I want to thank you for being with us, 27-year career analyst with the CIA.
You're most welcome.
Thank you. When we come back from break, we will look at Walmart and a new report called Discounting Rights, Walmart's Violation of U.S. Workers' Right to Freedom of Association.
There is power in a factory, power in the land, power in the hand of the worker. But it all amounts to nothing if together we don't stand. There is power in a union. Now the lessons of the past were all learned with workers' blood, the mistakes of the bosses we must pay for, from the cities and the farmlands to trenches full of mud. War has always been the boss's way, sir. The union forever defending our rights. Down with the blackleg, all workers unite. With our brothers and our sisters, together we will stand. There is power in a union. I long for the morning that they realize brutality and unjust laws cannot defeat us. Who'll defend the workers who cannot organize when the bosses send their lackeys out to cheat us? Money speaks for money, the devil for his own. Who comes to speak for the skin and the bone? What a comfort to the widow, a light to the child. There is power in a union. Hey! Yeah. The union forever defending our rights. Down with the blackleg, all workers unite. Brothers and our sisters, together we will stand. There is power in a union. There is power in a union.
There's power in a union, Billy Bragg, here on Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Today is May Day, or International Workers' Day. In 1886, the American Federation of Labor declared a national strike to demand an 8-hour workday. In 1889, the Socialist International declared May 1st a day of demonstrations. In 1947, a joint session of Congress pronounced May 1st Loyalty Day, but it's celebrated as a worker holiday around the world. As millions take to the streets here in the United States and around the world, the world's largest company is being accused of using strong-armed and illegal methods to undermine what is considered a cornerstone of workers' rights. In a new report released today, Human Rights Watch says the retail giant Walmart has used, quote, an arsenal of unlawful tactics to foster a culture of fear to prevent workers from forming unions. The tactics include employee spying, intimidation, and barring discussions or materials on union activity. In one case, Walmart managers repositioned security cameras to monitor union supporters. According to Human Rights Watch, Walmart workers have also been fired or threatened with the loss of jobs or benefits. While several other major corporations have been faulted for anti-union practices, Human Rights Watch says Walmart is unique, quote, for the sheer magnitude and aggressiveness of its anti-union apparatus. Walmart employs more than 1 million workers at nearly 4,000 stores in the U.S. Not one of its stores has managed to form a union. Carol Peer is the senior labor rights and trade researcher for Human Rights Watch. She researched and wrote the report, Discounting Rights, Walmart's Violation of U.S. Workers' Right to Freedom of Association. Carol Peer joins us in our Washington, D.C. studio. Welcome to Democracy Now!, Carol.
Thank you so much. It's a pleasure to be here.
Why don't you lay out your major findings in this report?
Our major findings is that Walmart is a case study in what is wrong with U.S. labor law. As you mentioned, there are other companies in the country that take advantage of the weaknesses in U.S. labor law to try to prevent union formation at their workplaces. And there are companies that take advantage of the ineffective labor law enforcement in this country. But Walmart stands out, as you said, for the sheer aggressiveness and the magnitude of its strategy to defeat union formation in the United States and prevent workers from exercising their right to organize. And the report explains how Walmart uses both lawful tactics, tactics that comport with the very feeble standards of U.S. labor law, and tactics that violate U.S. labor law as well. And together, these tactics create such a climate of fear and intimidation at Walmart stores across the country that workers are unable to freely choose whether or not to form a union.
Walmart declined our request for an interview today, but did issue a statement in response to Human Rights Watch. Walmart says, quote, "This pro-union report uses incomplete interviews and unsubstantiated allegations from as much as 6 to 7 years ago to support a union-backed bill before Congress that eliminates workers' rights to a private ballot vote on unionization. Contrary to the allegations in this report, Walmart respects our associates' right to a free and fair unionization vote through a private government-supervised process, and we remain committed to compliance with U.S. laws regarding workers' right to unionize." The Walmart statement goes on to say, "The fact is less than 5% of all retail workers in the United States are part of a union, so the current trend is not unique to Walmart. Walmart provides an environment of open communications and gives our associates every opportunity to express their ideas, comments, and concerns. It's because of our efforts to foster such an environment that our associates have repeatedly rejected unionization attempts." Carol Peer, your response.
There's so many things I'd like to respond to. I'll start first with the accusation that the report is incomplete and contains unsubstantiated claims. The report is 210 pages long and contains 932 footnotes, and we spent over 2.5 years researching it. It is a very thorough and objective documentation of Walmart's response to union activity at its stores across the country. We attempted to get in touch. We got in touch with Walmart on 3 separate occasions in writing, requesting to meet with them to get their perspective, to get their response to our findings. And on all 3 occasions, they declined. Second, I'd like to say that this is not a union-backed report. This is not a pro-union report. This is a report that is pro-freedom of association. We are a human rights organization that believes that workers should have the right to choose whether or not to form a union. If they choose not to, that's fine. If they choose to, that is fine. But we believe, because it is a fundamental human right that is protected in the key instruments of the United Nations, that workers have the right to freedom of association. And that is what is denied to Walmart workers. Walmart says that workers have an opportunity at their stores to freely choose whether or not to organize, and that they would be allowed to have a vote within the NLRB process, the National Labor Relations Board. That's what they were referring to in the response. That is a very disingenuous response to our report, because although perhaps workers could have a vote, what Walmart does from the moment that it detects union activity at a store is it responds with a hard-hitting and aggressive anti-union campaign. The company has a union hotline at headquarters that managers are required to call any time union activity is detected. The company sends in a labor relations team, which is a rapid reaction force that comes in from headquarters and starts to have meetings with the workers, telling them about the terrible consequences of union formation, showing them anti-union videos in which unions are depicted as antiquated organizations, and union representatives are shown as aggressive and unsavory characters. And the company does not provide a meaningful opportunity for the union supporters and union representatives to respond. It's not required to under U.S. labor law, and it doesn't. So workers are bombarded with Walmart's anti-union mantra repeatedly, over and over again. And that is what they hear. And that does not create a free and fair climate in which to have an election. Let's put it in the political context. Let's go back to the 2004 presidential campaign in the United States. What if George W. Bush had unlimited access to the airwaves, to radio, to television? He could have campaign rallies at which the general public was strongly urged, almost required to attend. And on the flip side, John Kerry was only able to access the voting public by sending campaign workers door to door. That is the unbalanced campaign atmosphere of a union campaign at Walmart stores. That is not a democratic process. That is not a fair process.
I want to play a clip now from what's believed to be a Walmart employee training video. This is a tape reportedly shown to new Walmart employees. It shows two newly hired workers, a human resources manager, and two long-standing employees discussing union activity. Human Rights Watch has posted the tape online, but Walmart has refused to confirm its authenticity.
You know, where I was before, a few people thought they needed a union. I mean, they were trying to get me to sign this card, but, you know, I wasn't so sure.
Well, here at Walmart, we have a great group of associates who take pride in how they work and where they work. They don't want a union.
Why not?
Because they know a union could just mess it up.
Walmart respects you and what you contribute to the company.
That money and respect, that's good.
Lots of respect. Back when I was in the union, I was just a number.
Okay, then what's a union do for you?
Well, if a union comes in, all it can do is negotiate, you know, ask for things, negotiate contracts.
Mm. And Julie, if a union got in here, every benefit we got could go on the negotiating table, every one of them. With all our benefits, well, we risk losing a lot.
I was just telling them that we have regular meetings with our associates. And at the meetings, we ask associates for feedback on various issues.
So you're saying you ask us what needs to be fixed?
I sure do. A lot of good changes have come from those meetings.
Companies with unions, they don't ask employees things like that?
Oh, no way. Now, with the union, you don't talk to your boss. You got to go to your union steward. And if he likes what you say...
Yeah, if. That's when I knew Julie had really lost interest in any kind of union talk. And both of us... Well, all of us. Every day, we see how our management listens and cares. You know, there's no way we want a union coming in. And we could lose a lot of the good things we just talked about. So welcome to Walmart. You're going to like it here. You've picked a great place to work.
Carol Peer of Human Rights Watch, where did you get this videotape?
We got it from two separate sources. Robert Greenwald, who's a documentary filmmaker. And we also got it from a local union. But this is not the first time that this video has been shown. It has been shown before on a PBS special. It has also been referenced in a book by Barbara Ehrenreich in which she discusses Walmart. We are very, very confident that this video is a training video that is shown at Walmart stores. But as you said, we contacted the company asking them to please authenticate the video, and they refused to do so.
I was just looking at the piece on your report in Business Week, the 210-page report. It says this is only the second time in Human Rights Watch's 29-year history that it's issued a book-size report on a corporation. The first one was on Enron in 1999. Why have you done such a massive piece? What has been the reasoning in Human Rights Watch, taking on, you know, major human rights issues around the world, now focusing here on Walmart?
We took on Walmart's violations of its workers' right to freedom of association because Walmart is the largest private corporation in the world. It is the largest private employer in the United States, the largest private employer in the world. And its conduct towards its workers, therefore, matters. So when we heard allegations of violations of workers' right to form and join trade unions. And we realized that there was no other report that really documented in detail the many, many tactics that compose Walmart's anti-union strategy, setting out a roadmap, if you will, which is what we set out to do with our report, of Walmart's strategy to thwart union formation, violate its workers' rights. We realized that this was a need, that this is an important issue, and that we needed to step up and show how Walmart violates its workers' right to freedom of association, taking advantage of weak U.S. labor laws. Because the potential impact of Walmart continuing this conduct and the United States continuing to have labor laws that are so weak that they are unable to prevent companies like Walmart from violating workers' rights, the consequences of that are just too terrible to consider with respect to the right of workers to organize in this country. We call on Walmart to change course, and we call on the United States to reform its labor laws. We call on the U.S. Senate to pass the Employee Free Choice Act, which passed the House on March 1st. President Bush has threatened to veto this important piece of labor legislation. We call on him to reconsider and to sign it into law. It would close many of the loopholes in weak U.S. labor law that help facilitate companies like Walmart in their efforts to violate workers' rights.
Carol Pirro, I want to thank you for being with us, senior labor rights and trade researcher for human rights. She researched and wrote the report Discounting Rights, Walmart's Violation of U.S. Workers' Right to Freedom of Association. We will link to the more than 200-page report on our website at democracynow.org.
Thank you so much.
Thank you for being with us. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. Back in a minute.
Aquí estoy establecido en los Estados Unidos. 10 años pasaron ya. En que crucé de mojado y papeles no he arreglado. Sigo siendo un ilegal. Tengo mi esposa y mis hijos. Los traje muy chicos y se han olvidado ya de mi México querido, del que yo nunca me olvido y no puedo regresar. ¿De qué me sirve el dinero si estoy como prisionero dentro de esta gran nación? Cuando me acuerdo hasta lloro, que aunque la jaula sea de oro, no deja de ser prisión.
Escúchame, hijo, ¿te gustaría que regresáramos a vivir a México?
What you talking about, Dad? I don't want to go back to Mexico. No way, Dad.
Mis hijos no hablan conmigo. Otro idioma han aprendido y olvidado el español.
Paula de Oro, de Los Tigres del Norte, here on Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Well, recently, the New York Daily News was awarded the Pulitzer Prize for an editorial series on the medical fallout from the 9/11 attacks. In its five-month series, 9/11, The Forgotten Victims, the Daily News looked at how more than 12,000 people have fallen ill from the contaminated air around Ground Zero. But in some circles, the Pulitzer Award was as noteworthy for whom it did not mention, Daily News columnist and Democracy Now! Co-host Juan Gonzalez. Juan was the first reporter to question government officials' insistence that the air around Ground Zero was safe. While most of his media colleagues bought the official line that 9/11 had posed no contamination threat, Juan continued to pursue the story. He was criticized by New York City and other government officials who even called the Daily News to complain. Juan's editors responded by relegating his columns to the back pages or even killing them. The Village Voice reported this week that this background was not lost on several Daily News staffers. According to The Voice, the announcement of the Pulitzer Prize was met with, quote, muted applause in the newsroom. The irony, The Voice reports, is, quote, stunning. The Daily News won one of journalism's highest prizes for writing about illnesses that might have been prevented had it not bowed to government and corporate pressure in 2001 and instead kept Gonzalez's prescient warnings in the public eye. Joining me here in our Firehouse studio is Keech Hagee. She covered this story for The Village Voice, where she's a staff reporter. Her piece is called Dishonorable Non-Mention. We're also joined by Joel Kupferman. He's executive director of the New York Environmental Law and Justice Project. He's with the National Lawyers Guild. We welcome you both to Democracy Now! Keech, talk about what you found this week just after the Pulitzers announced the award for the New York Daily News editorial board, but not for the leading columnist who did the pioneering pieces right after 2001, Juan Gonzalez.
Well, people sort of sipped their champagne with mixed emotion, at least some of them, at the Daily News. Those who were there in the newsroom at the time of in 2001 when Juan was struggling to get his pieces into the paper, people, you know, at the Daily News watched Juan be pushed down by some of the editors there and watched the city officials apply pressure to the publisher and editors of the paper.
The publisher being?
Mort Zuckerman. In fact, Christy Whitman from the Environmental Protection Agency wrote Mort
Zuckerman. The former governor of New Jersey.
Indeed. Wrote Mort Zuckerman a letter right after one of Juan's big pieces saying that the air was not safe around Ground Zero. And, you know, that letter found its way into the op-ed pages days later. You know, very few edits, and you know, from there on out, it was really hard for Juan to get his message in the front of the paper where it really mattered, where it could have maybe helped save lives.
The letter that she wrote said exactly what?
It accused Juan of trying to alarm people. You know, it said that government and media have a responsibility to say things in a calm manner, basically. Asking him to, you know, to stop putting this dangerous news that the air was not safe right front and center.
Joel Kupferman, talk about who you were representing after the attacks, your investigation, and Juan's significance in the reporting at the time.
My office is located downtown, just a few blocks from the World Trade Center, and I basically represented all the workers down there, all the residents, and the people that that grew up in that neighborhood. It was unbelievably dark and dusty. And what we did is we went down and we took samples right near the World Trade Center. And results that we came up with were shocking, were 5% asbestos and 90% fiberglass. And we wanted to get that news out. And the one person that we believed that could understand how significant that story was Juan Gonzalez.
I want to go to Juan Gonzalez in his own words. He spoke about his reporting on the 9/11 health fallout at a Democracy Now! Event we had here in New York on the anniversary of September 11th last year.
That as I began to write those stories, I must have written 10, 12, 15 columns over the following weeks and months. The attack that came down on the Daily News was astounding. I mean, it was really, and I've been in the business a long time. I've been in the mainstream media, corporate media now 30 years, and I'd never seen the kind of attack that came down on our newspaper. The day after the biggest story that we wrote on October 26th, the regional director of EPA held a press conference calling it the worst kind of story that could possibly be written. The head, Catherine Wild, who is runs the partnership in New York City, the major business group in the city, published an article, a letter to the editor, calling it irresponsible journalism and a sick Hollywood prank. Christy Whitman personally contacted the publisher of the Daily News, Mort Zuckerman, and the editor in chief. And requested the chance to rebut my articles, and she was given the opportunity a few days later to write an op-ed piece, basically attempting to discredit the articles. One of Rudy Giuliani's deputy mayors called a newspaper vociferously attacking its coverage. One of the great ironies is that that deputy mayor is now claiming that he is sick from exposure to 911 toxins. It's one of the great ironies that he was the one who made the call to try to stop the stories. It went on, and I would like to say that the newspaper was valiant and continued to press forward with the truth, but things don't always work out that way. There was enormous pressure inside the paper to stop the coverage, that maybe we were wrong, and my immediate supervisor, the Metropolitan editor of the newspaper, who backed me completely and who wanted to start a whole investigative team to look further into the problems. He formed the investigative team, and within a week, he was fired, and the investigative team was disbanded. He was demoted. He was demoted from Metropolitan Editor, and the investigative team was disbanded. The paper did continue to publish the other columns that that I wrote, only, I think, to some degree, because I basically told them, I said, well, you run the newspaper, you decide what you're going to print, but I decide as a columnist what I'm going to write. So because I think this is so important, and because I think 15 to 20 years from now, if we don't do something about this, we're going to be facing with thousands of people dying, I'm going to keep writing these columns, and you can decide what you're going to do with them. So they did continue to write them, but they put them further back in the more front pages. But they did run them. And I have to say that compared to all of the other media in the city at the time, the Daily News was the only one that at least paid some attention on a regular basis to the complaints and the concerns of thousands of people in Lower Manhattan over what was happening to them.
Juan Gonzalez, Joel Kupferman, what difference would it have made if these pieces got constant support and front page placement in the New York Daily News?
A lot less people would be sick today. Doctors would know how to treat people today. And even back then, people would have taken a lot more precautions of what they were wearing when they went back down there. And people wouldn't have moved back into that area. Students wouldn't go back to their schools. And there'd be a lot less people being sick. And I think it's very important to point out that what they said one statement was alarming. It wasn't false. They kept on just using it was alarmist. They didn't say he was sending false news. They just said he was sending alarming news.
Keach, the issue of the team that was put together for this editorial board campaign, they did bring in a reporter, right, Heidi Evans?
Yes, they did.
They could have brought in Juan Gonzalez into this, the New York Daily News as well,
to be
a part of this campaign, who did the original pioneering breakthrough journalism right after 9/11.
It's true. He's an expert on this topic, absolutely. And in fact, he's being recognized. The New York Committee for Occupational Safety and Health is recognizing both the editorial team and Juan later this month, which just shows you that there, you know, there is an understanding out there in the world that they both of their contributions were really important.
Joel Kupferman, as you did the research after 2001, the attacks, how hard was it to get these stories placed, and the significance of the business and real estate community here trying to bring people back to, well, right where we are right now within the evacuation zone, just blocks from Ground Zero?
Other than the Daily News and the BBC and the Italian press, it was most difficult. We gave reams and reams of information to many, many papers and networks, and they just looked the other way. They didn't look at all the data that actually showed how serious the situation was, and they just went along with the EPA headlines.
Joel Kupferman and Keach Hagee, I want to thank you both for being with us. Keach Hagee is a staff reporter at the Village Voice. Joel Kupferman with the National Lawyers Guild and New York Environment Law and Justice Project. Juan Gonzalez not only did the series of pieces in the New York Daily News, but he also wrote a book at the time called Fallout, The Environmental Consequences of the World Trade Center Collapse. And that does it for today's broadcast. Democracy Now! Produced by Mike Berkshire, Doug Deuce, John Hamilton, Elizabeth Press, Sarah Matei, Jen Utes, Mike DeFilippo, Nick Marsilio, and Miguel Noguera, our engineers. Our website, democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for joining us.